Welcome to the third and final 2009-10 P11D podcast, following on from the podcast that covered preparation and reporting and submission issues. In this podcast, I will look specifically at each entry on the P11D and talk you through the reporting and calculation of the expense payment or benefit in kind. It might help you to have to hand a copy of the 2009-10 form P11D. Starting at the top, and particularly if we are using paper returns, we need to fill in the details of the employer and employee, taking some care because of the quality standard set by HMRC, which could lead to the rejection of the P11Ds, where they are not fully and properly completed. We should remember the points that I made previously about the brown Class 1A, or the blue boxes, and have to hand a copy of the HMRC CWG5 booklet to refer to Appendix 1 Common Benefits, which will help us decide where on the P11D each item should be reported. Section A, Assets Transferred. Here we have to report the market value of any company asset transferred to the director or employee. The general rule of cost applies if the asset sold or transferred was a car, or any other asset that had never been used to provide a benefit. However, if the asset was previously provided as a benefit in kind, the cash equivalent is then the higher of the market value of the asset at the date of the transfer, or the market value of the asset when first applied as a benefit, and from that is deducted any sums already taxed on the use of the asset as a benefit. The problem area that tends to crop up mostly is the sale of a company car at below market value. Other problems that might occur is where employees are given assets, even items such as company clothing, given them free or below market value. Section B of the P11D deals with payments made on behalf of the employee. Not often completed. Here we should report any payments made by the employer on behalf of the employee, and the amount of any tax deductible on notional payments not immediately borne by the director or employee and not made good within 90 days of the receipt of each notional payment. This problem can occur where a director or employee does not have sufficient cash pay to enable the employer to recover the income tax due on, say, the exercise of unapproved share options. PAYE should have been applied to any employment income provided in the form of a cash voucher or readily convertible asset, or vouchers and credit tokens used to acquire such assets, or if they are readily convertible themselves. Section C, Vouchers and Credit Cards. Here we have to report any expense incurred in the provision of vouchers capable of being exchanged for money, goods or services, and any additional expenses incurred in providing the benefit. We should provide details of all expenses and other payments made, but not those in connection with cars which are dealt with under Section F, using credit cards or tokens, excluding amounts reported elsewhere as, say, entertaining, travel, subsistence, etc. We can exclude the value of any vouchers on which pay-as-you-earn has been operated, perhaps luncheon vouchers, where the excess over the 15 pence a day exempt amount might be put through the payroll. We need to remember that vouchers are liable to Class 1 National Insurance contributions unless exempt, and the Class 1 should have been paid by the 19th of April, which of course is already gone. We do not have to report the first £55 per week of any qualifying childcare vouchers provided by the employer. But if the employer provides a higher figure, it is only the excess that we have to report. So for example, £60 a week, we would only report £5 per week, £260 per annum. Next, Section D, Living Accommodation. It's important to point out, first of all, it's a Class 1A brown box section, but also that there is a working sheet, number 1, which can be used to calculate the cash equivalent of the benefit. There are two charges for living accommodation. The first is the basic charge based on the greater of the annual gross rateable value of the property or the rent paid by the employer, less any rent paid by the employee. the benefit is prorated if the accommodation is only available for part of the year. The second or additional charge is based on properties costing more than £75,000, and that has to include the cost of any improvements. If the cost of the accommodation including any improvements exceeds £75,000, the excess is converted into an annual rent charge by multiplying the excess over £75,000 by the official rate of interest at the beginning of the 2009-10 tax year. This was 4.75% on the 6th of April 2009. The value of any exempt job-related accommodation, such as a house or flat occupied by a school caretaker, may be excluded. We have to remember, however, to report other taxable benefits linked to the exempt accommodation. This might be the cost of light and heat, or repair and decoration costs, if met by the employer. Where the occupation of the property is exempt, the payment of the council tax and water rates is not a taxable benefit. Another additional taxable benefit connected to the accommodation would be the provision of furniture or fittings by the employer. These would be taxed under the use of assets rules, which I'll discuss shortly. The next section, sections E to G. Section E, mileage allowance payments and passenger payments. HMRC provide a working sheet number 6 to cover this. We have to report the excess over and above the authorised mileage rates of 40p a mile for the first 10,000 business miles and 25p per mile thereafter. For mileage allowance payments, the approved amount is the number of business miles travelled other than as a passenger multiplied by the appropriate rate of 40p or 25p. The question is, does the employer have a system in place to check if any director or employee has exceeded the tax relief available, for example, paying 40p a mile for more than 10,000 business miles? For passenger payments, the approved amount is the number of business miles travelled by either car or van for which a passenger is carried and in respect of which passenger payments are made by the employer. The rate is 5p per mile. And passenger payments can be paid in respect of company cars or vans for which the employees charge as a benefit in kind. Section F deals with company cars and car fuel benefits. This again is a Class 1A brown box section, and here again also HMRC provides working sheet number 2 to help calculate the benefits. Employers must provide details of the cars made available for private use and the total car benefit charge. The car benefit charge isn't based on use of the car, it's based on availability. To calculate the car benefit, we have to go through a series of steps, finding the price of the car, adding the price of any accessories which fall to be taken into account, making any required deductions for capital contributions by the employee, then taking the lower of the amount carried forward from step 3 and the £80,000 limit that currently applies but which is shortly to be abolished. What I mean by that is if someone has a £100,000 car, at the moment, the limit to be applied is £80,000. We then have to find the appropriate percentage for the car based on the CO2 emissions of the car. We multiply the price by the percentage to arrive at the car benefit. We also, having done that, can make a deduction for any payments made by the employee or director for the private use of the car. The price of a car means its list price, if it has one, or its notional price, if it has no list price. But rarely will we come across a car without a list price. The list price is the inclusive price published by the manufacturer, importer, or distributor of the car if sold singly in a retail sale in the open market. It's not the discounted price. The list price must include standard accessories, any relevant taxes such as VAT, car tax, any customs or excise duties, any tax chargeable as if it were a customs duties and delivery charges. But it doesn't include the car registration fee and it doesn't include the road fund license. If a car is not available for some time during the tax year, No adjustment can be made unless the period when the car was not available totaled at least 30 consecutive days. We have to report the list price of the car and the optional accessories fitted to the car when first made available. There is a difference when accessories are added after the car was first made available, because we can ignore the cost of any accessories which cost under £100. I've mentioned capital contributions which an employee might make towards the purchase of a car, perhaps towards the purchase of a tow bar to be fitted to the car. Capital contributions up to £5,000 can be used to reduce the list price of the car. If an employee makes a payment towards the private use of the car, as opposed to a capital contribution, that will reduce the benefit in kind after it's been calculated. The CO2 emissions of the car can be obtained from the logbook and then checked against the revenue's published guidelines on CO2 emissions. We have to remember to add 3% to the CO2 figure for diesel cars, except those diesel cars that were Euro 4 qualifying and registered before 31st of December 2006. The cash equivalent of each car must be reported, then the total cash equivalent for all cars available in 2009-10 are shown in box 10. Next, let me look at the provision of car fuel for private motoring, which is one of the major issues picked up so often by HM Revenue and Customs officers. The cash equivalent of fuel for each car fuel benefit charge should be shown, and then the total cash equivalent of fuel for all cars made available in 2009 should be entered in box 10 of the P11D. A car fuel benefit charge will apply unless fuel or any mileage allowance was provided solely for business travel, or alternatively, the director or employee was required to make good the cost of any private motoring and actually did make good. Making good can be by a payment to cover the cost of any private fuel, or by replacing or replenishment of the fuel used for private motoring. But be warned, HMRC will check the method used, and they will seek to impose fuel scale charges if the records are not sufficient to prove that no private fuel was provided. Next section is section G for company vans. Again, it's a brown box, class 1A. And again, HMRC provide a working sheet, this time number 3, to help calculate the benefit. Employers are required to report the cash equivalent of all vans made available for unrestricted private use. If there's restricted private use, then the benefit will not have to be reported. The report is at box 9 for the van benefit and box 10 for the fuel benefit. A van is defined as a mechanically propelled road vehicle which is of a construction primarily suited for the conveyance of goods or burden of any description and of a design weight not exceeding 3,500 kilograms or 3.5 metric tons. Sometimes we need to be clear about whether a vehicle is a van or a company car. And this is particularly a problem with double cab pickup vehicles, which might be a car or might be a van. You need to check that out. Where a taxable benefit does arise, the cash equivalent is a standard charge of £3,000 per van used for unrestricted private use. There is also a £500 charge where private fuel is provided with that company van. The full charge applies if the van is used as a benefit throughout the year. The benefit is apportioned if the employee commenced or ceased to use the van privately during the year, and like company cars, it can be reduced for any periods where it was unavailable for 30 consecutive days or more. The benefit for any shared vans is apportioned between the users in proportion to their use, so that if you have a team of two people sharing the use of a van, they might be taxed on 50% of the benefit each. Section H, interest-free and low-interest loans. Again, a brown box class 1A section, and again, HMRC provides a working sheet, this time number 4, to assist with the calculation of the benefit. The provision of an interest-free or low-interest loan to an employee or to a member of the family or household by virtue of the employment is a taxable and reportable benefit. A company loan is regarded as a beneficial loan when arranged or facilitated by the employer or a third party on behalf of the employer, and the rate of interest is less than the official rate of interest. That was 4.75% throughout the tax year 2009-10. We do not have to report loans used wholly for a qualifying purpose, and for that you need to look at Chapter 17 and Appendix 5 of the Booklet 480. Employers are required to report the cash equivalent for each non-qualifying loan separately, except where a closed company elects to treat all non-qualifying loans in the same currency and owing at the same time as one loan. The employer is also required to report the purpose of the loan. A would be a loan used for the purpose of a trade, professional, vocation. B, a loan used for the purchase of a main residence. C, a loan used for the purpose eligible for relief other than the purchase of a main residence. D, we would note as a loan not within A, B, or C. E is a loan given as part of a relocation package, and we would note it as F, where the purpose of the loan is simply not known. The next section is Section I, Private Medical Treatment or Insurance. Again, a Class 1A section, but this time no working sheet. The provision of private medical treatment or insurance, except medical insurance cover for overseas duties, is a taxable and reportable benefit, but it is not a taxable benefit for P9D employees, in other words, those employees earning at less than a rate of £8,500. Employers have to report the cost of any private medical or dental treatment or insurance premiums, and the cost of any excess on the medical insurance cover, if that cost is met by the employer. Any amount made good should be deducted, and the net cash equivalent will be reported in Box 11. If an employer pays the excess on the policy, that is an additional benefit to be reported on the P11D. Section J, Qualifying Relocation Expenditure. Again, a Class 1A brown box, and here again we have a working sheet number 5 provided by HMSE to help calculate the benefit. The cost of relocating an employee is reported here under qualifying expenditure, and then again at Section N of the P11D, where it is non-qualifying expenditure. Employers have to report for each move the excess over the £8,000 tax relief limit of qualifying relocation expenses, payments and benefits at Box 15. A relocation will qualify for tax relief if the employee moves within the employment, perhaps on promotion, or it could be to take up a new employment, and providing that the new residence is within reasonable daily travelling distance of the new workplace. Qualifying expenditure includes the cost of selling the old home and buying the new one, including legal expenses, stamp duty, estate agent's fees, removal fees, and the cost of travel between the old home and the new workplace until a new permanent home is found. It also includes the cost of temporary accommodation at the new location whilst the employee looks for more permanent accommodation. It is important to remember that the £8,000 tax relief is not an annual limit, and you must therefore establish the cost of any qualifying items incurred last year and take this into account. There is a time limit of 12 months after the end of the tax year in which the relocation takes place. Section K, Services Supplied. We have to report the cost of any services supplied to the employee, and you must take into account any amount paid by the employee or from which income tax was deducted to arrive at the net cash equivalent to be reported at Box 15. The cost of any in-house services, such as tax advice provided to employees of an accountancy firm or conveyancing services provided to employees of a law firm, is not taxable. The charge, if any, would be based on the marginal or additional cost incurred. The employee of the law firm would be expected to pay the actual cost of items such as search fees, which would otherwise give rise to a taxable and reportable benefit. Section L, Assets Placed at the Employee's Disposal. Here the reporting requirement is based on the annual value of the use of the employer asset, and that annual value is 20% of the market value of the asset when it was first used to provide a benefit, or any sum paid by the employer by way of a rent or hire charge for the asset. We have to provide a description of the asset and report the gross benefit comprising the annual value, including any additional expenses incurred in provision of the asset. Some employer-provided assets are exempt from a tax charge where the private use is regarded as insignificant. There isn't a taxable benefit if an employer provides equipment such as a wheelchair or a urinate to an employee with a disability, when it is provided to enable the employee to take up or retain their work, and where the employee uses the equipment or significant private use. problems that occur with this action is where the employer, say, provides a painting to the director or employee to hang in their home, and that's the use of an asset which should be reported as a taxable benefit. Other problems that the revenue are looking for might include the provision of clothing to employees which does not qualify as uniform. This could be in a retail shop where employees are wearing the store clothing to advertise that clothing, but it is still regarded as a taxable benefit. Next, Section M, other items. As I've already said, Section M is the only dual choice section where you must decide whether or not there's a Class 1 National Insurance Contribution liability and whether the item should be included in the brown box for Class 1A or whether it should be in the blue box. This is effectively one of the catch-all sections of the P11D, sweeping up the entries that do not automatically fit elsewhere. It's not possible to give an exhaustive list, but the main items that you're likely to encounter are as follows. Firstly, subscriptions and professional fees. We should report the cost to the employer of any subscriptions paid by the employer as the cash equivalent of the benefit. However, if the subscriptions or fees are job-related, and certainly if they're included in the HMRC published list number 3, or come within the terms of ITPA 2003 sections 343 or 344, they will not be taxable and they should be included in a P11D dispensation. If they're not covered by a dispensation, they have to be reported and the employee will have to claim a deduction. Taxable expenses to be reported year might include leisure clubs such as a golf or gym subscription. Dining club subscriptions may also need to be reported year. The next one here is non-qualifying relocation benefits, which are not included in Section J, where we would report the cost to the employer or any third-party provider of any non-qualifying relocation benefits in kind that do not qualify for tax relief. Another item within Section M could be loans written off or waived, where we would report the amount of any loans written off or waived unless written off by virtue of the death of the employee. Section N, expenses payments made to or on behalf of the employee. This is another sweeping up section, which covers expense payments as opposed to benefits in kind. It highlights the need to report expenses made to and those paid on behalf of the employee. Most employees should have or be able to obtain a P11D dispensation to cover the majority of business expenditure included under this heading. The amount of any travelling and subsistence expenses not covered by dispensation should be reported year, and that will include any travel between home and a permanent workplace for UK employments and employments performed wholly outside the UK. Expenses to be reported include fares, hotels, meals, etc. A major item to be reported year is entertainment, and it's important to point out there's no separate entries for business entertainment or staff entertainment or working lunches. The first obligation on the P11D is to identify whether or not the employing company is a trading organisation. This will normally confirm that the cost of business entertainment has been disallowed in the company accounts. HMRC officers will compare the tax computations with information reported on P11Ds and are likely to investigate apparent discrepancies. Employees of non-trading organisations may be asked to prove that the expense was incurred wholly, exclusively, and necessarily in the performance of the duties in order to avoid a tax charge. Lunches provided as part of a job-related training course should not be treated as giving rise to a taxable benefit. Where employees have lunch when working away at a temporary workplace, the cost should be treated as allowable travel and subsistence. The problem areas would be staff entertaining, and this is one of the most popular issues to give rise to settlements with HMRC. The cost of food and drink taken at or near the normal place of work, including food for staff working late, meals and drinks when discussing business outside of the office, and food and drink at team meetings will normally be a taxable staff entertaining benefit. Next, let's look at payments for use of home telephones. We have to report any expenses incurred in connection with the provision of a telephone at the home of the director or employee. The payment of any part of the employee's personal rental cost will be taxable and liable to Class 1 National Insurance, whereas the cost of identifiable business calls will be tax deductible. Next, I want to look at non-qualifying relocation expenses payments. And the important point here, this is expenses payments that are not qualifying and where we have to report the amounts in Section N. This could, for example, include compensation payments for the loss on the sale of a property. Also within this section would be incidental overnight expenses, where you're required to report the cost of any personal incidental overnight expenses if the director or employee incurs amounts in excess of the £5 per night allowance in the UK or £10 per night allowance overseas. For other expenses, we would include them here as part of the effectively sweeping up facility. We've looked over three separate PLMD podcasts at the preparation, the reporting and submission, and the calculation of the benefits. And I have to say that PLMD reporting is difficult and it is time consuming. And of course, any failure to complete this exercise accurately and on time could prove very costly in terms of interest and penalties. The additional work in producing many more PLMDs than are necessary has a knock-on effect on the directors and employees, and this should be avoided by obtaining a PLMD dispensation. Where there are taxable items that are picked up during a review for preparing PLMDs and the employer doesn't want to include them on the PLMDs, a PAY settlement should be considered. What we've done in these podcasts is to look in some detail at the reporting of expenses and benefits. But I should recommend that you may want to consider attending the CPD PLMD courses because they will cover the topics in much more detail. There are now only two PLMD courses to be run this year, and the first is on the 8th of May in Birmingham, and the second will be on the 15th of May in London. However, I hope to see some of you there. In the meantime, thank you for listening to these podcasts, and I hope they help you with the task ahead.